Welcome, everybody, to a Friday Fireside Chat. It is Friday. It is June 23rd. My name is Rita McGrath. You probably knew that. A couple of just housekeeping notes before we get going for real in this program. This is being recorded, so don't say anything you don't want your grandmother, best friend, or significant other to find out about. We do make the recordings available, and they'll be sort of 4 or 5 days after this live session. They'll be up on YouTube, together with all the other recordings of many Fireside Chats that we've done over the years, including my previous one with today's guest, Zeynep Ton, a dear friend, a professor at MIT, someone I've respected and admired for many, many years, someone we've tried to co-author with. We haven't made it happen yet. It will happen at one of these stages. And for today's purposes, the author of this terrific new book, The Case for Good Jobs, which basically makes the case that we think about jobs and we think about customer service and loyalty and the things that employees can do for us all wrong. So in the next hour or so, we'll be exploring what that looks like. So Zeynep, thank you so much for making the time to join.
Thank you so much for having me, Rita, and the admiration is mutual.
Indeed. But this is one of the best parts of my job, right? I get to talk to people I really, really like about things that interest them. So I thought before jumping into the current book, let's talk a little bit about your journey, because what fascinates me about this has now become something of your life's work, but it wasn't always that way. You started off doing solid research and came across some anomalies, which caused you to dig more deeply into this whole jobs question.
Yes, and 25 years ago, I never thought jobs would be part of my, you know, my journey, because, you know, I studied industrial engineering, and then I was a doctoral student at Harvard Business School and studying operations management, specifically retail supply chains. And I joined a group of researchers doing a project called Rocket Science Retailing. And
I love that. I didn't know that was what it was called.
Objective was to use data and smart algorithms to help retailers maximize profits. And, you know, in our world of operations, you know, managing product availability is all about planning, forecasting demand, optimizing inventory levels, assortment, etc. And what I and my colleagues found very early in our journey was that product availability was not just a planning or data problem. It was very much a people and work design problem, because inside the retail stores, oftentimes products were in the wrong place. Inventory data were inaccurate. Promotions were not carried out. There were all sorts of inventory-related problems that cost companies tens of millions of dollars in lost sales, lost productivity, future merchandising decisions that were wrong as a result of inaccurate data. And of course, the question was, why do these problems happen all the time? And that's where I, as an operations management person, met the people side of operations, because every company that I analyzed and then I worked with during the last, you know, many years, units that have more turnover have more problems. Units that are understaffed have more problems. Units that don't have enough training have more problems. And this is what led me to my, you know, first book, and then my now second book, and also the work that I do with companies through Nonprofit Good Jobs Institute.
Well, what I think is so fascinating about that is you started off with the hard stuff, right? The logistics. And I recall one of, I think it was a passage in your first book, when you talk about coming across this big revolution in operations science, which was this whole, what do they call them, workforce management systems, the ones that schedule, the scheduling management systems. But that ironically, when companies put these in, you know, which, and the idea behind this is, if you've got a heavy demand at, you know, 12 o'clock to 2 o'clock, you bring in more staff, and then those staff go away. And then if you got heavy demand at 8 o'clock to 9 o'clock, you bring in more people, and those people go away. And despite the seeming attractiveness of that from an efficiency point of view, what it actually led to was worse performance. And when you dig into why, it's because it leads to unpredictable schedules. It leads to people not knowing what they're going to be called on in advance. It leads to short lead times for people being asked to turn up when maybe they have a commute of an hour and a half by bus, you know. And I thought that was so interesting, that this thing that was supposed to lead to better performance actually depressed it.
And it was interesting, Rita, because when I started looking at companies from outside as a researcher, and I have a paper on understaffing, how, you know, you think workload is this much and you staff your stores at this level. And of course, you're seeing people as a cost to be minimized. And that end up hurting, as you said, profits, because it causes so many different things. But as I started working with companies, I also started seeing how much of a disconnect there is between what the system thinks the workload is versus what the workload actually is on the units. We work with so many companies where the managers would say, hey, we try to schedule our employees very well. We try to give them enough time to be able to do their jobs. But what they don't take into account is during the last couple of weeks, there have been so many new pilots that were run at the stores. They don't realize that there are all these different requests from HR, logistics, finance, asset control that came in oftentimes at different times and oftentimes at the same time or none at all. So super unpredictability in workloads. What they don't take into account was, you know, merchandising changed their mind, or the truck that was supposed to come to the store on a Monday came on a Tuesday. So all this stuff is not incorporated into those workload management software, what the number is. And of course, you know, it's the output is only as good as the accuracy of that number there. And then the result is chaos for employees, their lives are disrupted, for operations and for customers.
And we've all had that experience. You go into a store and things aren't in the right place. Nobody can help you. You don't know where you are. It's a really bad experience. And so you end up, you know, shutting up shop and walking away. So let's, and we'll see where we want to take it. But there's a couple of things I really want to make sure that our listeners understand. And the first one is, at a decision-making managerial 30,000 foot level, we actually have absolutely no concept of how many bad jobs are out there and what the consequences are for the people that have them. So maybe just give us some of the background on just the lay of the land.
Yeah, and I will start by saying when we think about what is a good job, we also have a misunderstanding of what a good job is. And, you know, what is a good job to start with? Let's start with that definition and we'll get at, you know, the numbers. You know, at a minimum level, people have to be treated like a human being with respect as opposed to a pair of hands, right? And in a good job, you need to be able to make enough money so that, you know, you can take control over your life. And so many workers in the United States, outside the United States, end up making too little to make ends meet. And there's tremendous lack of awareness in companies in terms of how many people don't make enough money to make ends meet. And when workers don't make enough and they have multiple jobs, they are constantly, you know, shuffling different jobs. They can't sleep. There's constant stressing about, you know, do I pay for this or do I pay for that? How do I put food on the table? Everything else that you do then as a company, the belonging programs, the, you know, well-intentioned recognition programs, pizza parties, they're just
free ski slope admissions. I love that one. Free ski slope admissions.
I mean, that was incredible. It was at a senior living organization we work with. These were workers who were making minimum wage, working multiple jobs, and executives, when they were deciding about what benefits to offer, they talked about offering discounts on ski lifts. And so that's the type of disconnect that we have. And I think, you know, then when pay is low, workers end up in a vicious cycle of poverty, and it hurts their physical health, it hurts their mental health, it hurts their cognitive functioning, and they end up not being able to perform well on the job. So we don't talk about pay as much when we talk about what is a good job, because those of us who make more than enough pay underestimate the impact of pay on workers' well-being and their ability to a good job. And I think we don't talk about pay as much because executives think in certain industries that higher pay is just unaffordable for them. But when pay is missing, of course, high pay alone doesn't make a job a good job, but the absence of pay guarantees a bad job and it guarantees turnover. And when turnover is high, then companies end up designing a system that ensures that they treat workers as a pair of hands, not human beings who can make decisions, who can improve performance. So pay is a huge part of what makes a good job. And just some statistics, you know, in the United States before COVID, Brookings Institute found that 53 million Americans, that's 44% of the workforce, worked in low-wage jobs where the median pay was $17,950.
How much?
Think $17,950. So think about, and pay is a two-pronged problem. There's the hourly wage, and there's a number of hours. And in so many service jobs, people don't get to work, even full-timers, 40 hours a week, every single week.
Well, and I think that's almost a hidden, I don't know about hidden issue, right? That you know, we have laws that sort of say, oh, if you have people that work more than, I'll make it up, 35 hours a week, they have to have the following benefits. And so you have all these people working exactly 34.5 hours a week, you know, and there's some countries where this happens too, where, you know, they'll have, like, what they do is they create a company. And if you have up to 50 people, you have to have such, and then if you get more than 50 people, you have to do Y. And you see these step change effects of the size of companies. So I think a lot of times our regulatory regime creates these unintended consequences.
And executives are so nervous about going over 40 hours because then they pay an hour and a half that they would rather schedule even the full-timers fewer than 40 hours a week.
Oh, I see. Okay. So it's overtime.
And even full-timers tend to have unpredictable schedules. You know, what we don't talk about enough oftentimes also is it's not just hours and pay, but it's the consistency of those hours. When your schedule changes week to week, your income varies week to week. Oftentimes your hours vary week to week, which makes it very difficult to hold on to a second job and have a sane life.
Mm-hmm. Well, not to mention childcare, education, development.
And what is amazing to me is how many companies say, oh, you know what, but we offer college tuition reimbursement. Well, when your workers are working multiple jobs, they can't make ends meet. They come home physically just, you know, they have no energy to go to have another education, but these seem like easier things to talk about. They're less expensive, and that's where companies tend to focus on.
So good pay. Lay out the other elements of a good job, because I think it's important for people to see it in its totality. Because I think we have this myth, oh, if you just pay people well and we have, you know, kumbaya, it'll be great. But that's not it. It's got to be good pay plus operational issues.
Good pay, stable schedules, career paths so you can move on to a higher paying job. Of course, safety and security. These are the basic needs that all humans have. And then there's a ton of research from psychology that shows that, you know, a job that is engaging, that's motivating, is one that creates a sense of achievement, a sense of belonging, purpose, meaningfulness, and recognition. These are all aspects of what makes a good job. But absence of basic needs just ensures that, you know, that turnover is high.
So why do employers do this? I mean, if I, you know, and I, when you and I work with a lot of executives, none of them think of themselves as cheapskates or bad people. I mean, by and large, a few maybe, but by and large, they think of themselves as good people. So why would they perpetuate a system that is so bad for so many people?
Yeah, I, you know, we have generations of leaders who have been taught that labor is just another input to production. Labor is just another cost to be managed, like soybeans, right? Market pay is the right pay, even if it's not a living wage. And lean and mean is what drives efficiency. And these leaders, Rita, some of them cannot even imagine operating in any other way because this has been drilled into their heads that you must pay market pay. I remember having a conversation with the board member of a hotel company. And she said, when I asked her, you know, have you quantified employee turnover? And have you looked at what percentage of your frontline employees, the full-timers, make a living wage? She said to me, we're not running a charity. We're running a public company. And when I pointed out the public companies and many more that are able to pay their employees so much more than the market, than the average in their industry, and create good jobs and create fantastic value for their investors, the answer was, well, they must be exceptions. It would never work for us. So there's a generation of leaders, I think, who have been taught this way. And the way that we teach our students also makes it very difficult for them to imagine any other way either. I'll give you an example. So first, let me just say, higher pay alone is not enough, right? When to be able to create high performance, you know, what does it take to have a winning team? I wrote this book, The Good Job Strategy, and it's not about higher pay. It's about winning, right? Winning with your customers. What does it take to win? You need to have a strong team. So you invest in people, in terms of pay, benefits, all that stuff, but you also design their work so that they're set up for success. You design their work for high productivity, high contribution, and that's the combination of operational choices that increase productivity and contribution and investment in people is what I call the good job strategy. But this is a system. It's a system that works together. But oftentimes the way that academia has been going in the research streams and the way that we teach our students, especially using analytics and numbers to make decisions, is let's identify cause and effect relationships in isolation as rigorously as possible. So I have seen so many companies that had said, hey, we've increased our staffing levels before, it didn't improve performance. We increased our pay before, it didn't reduce turnover. We empowered our employees before, but it didn't improve performance. These are all the things that they, all the conclusions they arrived at using rigorous analysis. But the thing is, of course, pay alone doesn't reduce turnover. Of course, you can empower alone. So that siloed decision-making, oftentimes looking at the past, prevents leaders from imagining what the future might be. One of the companies that adopted the good job strategy recently is Sam's Club. Ah. It's a $60 billion retailer. John Furner, their CEO at the time, when he said that he wanted to raise pay, and he was thinking about raising pay $5 to $7 an hour from a basis of $15 an hour, HR said, don't raise pay. Last time you raised pay, it didn't reduce turnover. Finance said, it's not in the budget. And then he said, thank you so much. But, you know, for us to be able to win with our customers, we have to execute well. For us to be able to execute well, we can't have high turnover. For us to be able to reduce turnover, we have to pay people more. Like logic, very logical, right? But that logic that seems so obvious is oftentimes not followed because, you know, we fall into what the data say.
Mm-hmm. Well, and, you know, we run into this trouble that the data are very skewed towards what you can measure. And the consequences of offering good jobs are sometimes downstream outcomes of decisions that you make earlier. I mean, I talk a lot about leading indicators, and you know, a lot of the data that we gather to draw conclusions from are all lagging indicators. They're information about stuff you can't fix. The other thing that I think is very poignant about your work is if you think of people as units of revenue generation rather than units of cost, you look at them completely differently. And I mean, this is an old example now, but you had in a case of the IKEA store that does the closets. Do you remember that? And they couldn't sell these closet inserts in IKEA. They couldn't make it work until they finally put a couple of people in that store who said, oh, let me show you how to measure the thing. And you want to store hats, this is what you need. You want to store jeans, this is what you need. And all of a sudden sales skyrocketed because now the customers knew what they wanted. They had confidence that they were buying the right thing.
You're exactly right. How you view people, whether you view them as a cost to be minimized or as drivers of profit, makes a huge difference. And how much you trust people makes a huge difference too. Because in these low pay, high turnover environments, leaders see employees who are not showing up on time. They have attendance problems because of whatever else is happening in their life. They can't focus on the job. They make mistakes. They don't serve the customer well. And they conclude that those frontline employees can't be trusted to make decisions. They can't be empowered. And if in return, they end up designing a system that, you know, that's totally command and control, that doesn't empower people. But when you look at, you know, companies, you mentioned IKEA, I'll mention Costco, Four Seasons. I remember, you know, if you talk to the founder of Costco, Jim Sinegal, in his mind, I mean, it's so obvious that you will see people as drivers of revenue, they're drivers of growth. He told my students, I asked him, I said, Jim, how did you from the very first store, you know, very first store that you opened as an entrepreneur at the time, you were paying people double the market. Like what made you believe that, and you were offering the lowest prices to customers, right? What made you believe that this would work? And his response was, he said, 70 cents of every dollar we spend to run our company goes to people. This tells you pretty significantly how important people are. If you don't manage that well, you're going to end up screwing up your company pretty badly. And in the last 20 years, I just saw the million ways in which companies are screwed because they're not, they, you know, because they go cheap on their most important input. Mm-hmm. When we work with companies, we ask them, I mean, we work with them to quantify as much as possible all the costs associated with their status quo. Because, you know, many leaders believe that higher pay is not affordable. It's very expensive. But when they leave our two-day workshop, they realize that low pay is actually a lot more expensive. And what is the cost of low pay? You know, one of the costs is turnover. We have employee turnover. It's some companies, you know, they change their roster, the complete roster every year, 100% turnover. We've observed turnover 40% to 300% in various organizations. And just the direct turnover cost alone, right? You know, recruiting, hiring, onboarding, time to full productivity, those costs alone can be 10 to 45% of payroll. But those direct turnover costs are small compared to all the operational execution costs that I have seen earlier in my research, lost sales, waste, shrink, you know, low productivity. And those costs are small compared to the competitive costs. Mm-hmm. If you don't have a winning team that's set up to succeed, how can you create great service to your customers? Right? How can you? I mean, it's just for these leaders, Rita, though, it's so obvious that, of course, you invest in your employees. Of course, because they're the ones who are meeting the customers. Sorry, that was a very long answer to,
I think the lack of awareness of how bad jobs are. And I think also, you know, back to my well-intentioned executives, they've got no personal experience with this. No. You know, they don't come home at the end of a week worried about how can they afford something important over the weekend. That's just not the life that they live. So it's very hard for them to really understand it. And do you have any suggestions for how they might? I mean, I have a bunch of obvious ones, but are there techniques you found particularly useful in getting people to wake up and realize what's right under their noses?
Yes. And maybe first I will mention the lack of awareness is not only just about how low pay is and how difficult it is for their employees to do, you know, to be able to do a good job, but the lack of awareness also about how much different functions in the home office ends up making it very difficult for the front lines to do a good job because of uncoordinated requests, because of silos making decisions, focusing on their own metrics, right? Transportation, thinking about how do I minimize transportation costs and not thinking that, well, if I rechange the delivery to the stores because it minimizes, it reduces my transportation costs, it hurts employees' schedules. So there's lack of awareness about how the front, you know, home office functions, how their decisions affect the front lines and their ability to do a good job. So what's the cure? I wish there was a cure. For the pay stuff, one is look at the data. Right. Look at calculate every company we work with. We have them look at what percentage of their frontline employees, full timers, not part timers, but full timers, are able to make a living wage in their own county. And MIT has a great living wage calculator that can be used for this. And it's eye opening for these executives. I remember at PayPal when they found out that two-thirds of their employees ran out of money paycheck to paycheck. It was eye-opening. So use data to understand that part. But for the others, go to the front lines. Spend time in the front lines. We just finished a workshop with a retail chain. And at the end of the workshop, one of the executives stood up and he was all very positive in the beginning. And he said, I'm very upset because I had no idea what was happening in our front lines. And he said that from now on, he will be visiting more, spending time in the front lines and looking at the work and making it better. So go spend as much time as possible with the front line and really understand what's happening.
So one of the questions one of our Frank Kalberg wants to know is why are the wages people earn in some large companies very different for the same kind of work? Do you have a thought on that?
Not really. Not, I'm not sure. I mean, there are sometimes cost of living differences across different places. So companies might offer different pay in different parts of the United States. But I haven't looked into either gender gaps or those types of issues.
Yeah, I mean, Frank, what I can tell you from the research I've done is a lot of it has to do with path-dependent accumulation of pay. So the early decisions that get made by people's managers, because so often future pay is based on past pay, an early path-dependent break accumulates. So it's like one of those cumulative compounding. That's the word I was looking for, compounding differences. So play that out over 5 or 10 years, and you can end up with people in very similar jobs earning very different things. But so back to the case. So this book was written to get people, A, to pay attention, B, to do something, C, to maybe contribute towards a more fair and just way of handling workforce relations. So do you have the sort of, we talked about pay, we've talked about the design of basically good jobs. Are there things you want people to really remember as data points that really could cause them to look at this? Maybe they aren't, it isn't top of mind, but what would cause them to say, oh, wow, this is something I really should be getting on my agenda and paying attention to?
Yes. Yeah, so I think, you know, when I wrote my first book, it showed that you can pay more, you can create good jobs, even in low wage, you know, low cost retail settings. And this is how you do it. And the reaction was, yeah, but I'm not operating that way. Like, yeah, you're talking about Costco, Trader Joe's, Quick Trip, but I'm not that. In this book, what I try to get, what I try to inspire others with is that look at the case studies of changes from, you know, 2 units of a restaurant, small business restaurant, to call centers at Quest Diagnostics, to a $60 billion company, and look at the outcomes that they have been able to generate. One, significantly lower turnover. I mean, from 25% at Sam's Club within 2 years, 25% reduction in employee turnover, to cutting it by more than half at Quest Diagnostics call centers in 18 months. So you can reduce turnover levels dramatically within a not, you know, 10-year horizon, but within a 2-year, 18-month horizon, or in the case of Mudbay, another company, 3-year horizon. So lower turnover, much higher labor productivity. I'll give you an example from Sam's Club. One of their executives did a fantastic interview with Steve Prokesh at Harvard Business Review in the previous HBR issue. And he said, before we adopted the system, when we looked historically at how much we can raise efficiency, it was 1 to 2%. That was even like good enough. We've increased efficiency 20% during the last 3 years. So it's a step change in performance. It's not, you know, just a little bit incremental improvement. It's a step change in performance. So the other big upside is productivity. Mudbay, a retail chain in the Northwest, increased their sales per square foot significantly. They were labor productivity significantly. And the third data point is how much they improved their customer satisfaction and sales, which means that now they're more competitive because they're providing their customers a reason to come back to buy from them, right? So Quest Diagnostics started this journey because turnover costs were high, but also they were losing some of their accounts because their call center reps were not able to answer the phone on time or not solve their customers' problems. So this enabled them to hold on to their customers. So those are some of the data points that I hope inspire people to make changes. And the other thing is, the changes these companies made them a much stronger business that wins with their customers, much more productive. Those changes also change lives of employees. Mm-hmm. They change. I mean, at Sam's Club, I remember when they announced the first pay increases, people who cried. There were people who said, I have to call my wife because now I don't have to have a second job. And for leaders to be able to make this much of an impact on, you know, winning with their customers and also on the lives of their employees has been so meaningful. And it's been such a privilege for me and my colleagues at Good Jobs Institute to witness. And I hope more leaders get to feel this way by making these changes.
Well, it's a very human thing, right? And I think one of the things that I find personally very frustrating is these issues are so polarizing about, you know, did we do the right thing for people? And is this community left behind? And you really offer a very positive path that doesn't require taking a side or a weakening issue, but that really says here's a set of basic human qualities that can be quantified, can be measured. And we know what to do. We know how to solve them. I remember years ago, you and I were talking about doing a sort of a controlled experiment where we put good jobs in one branch of, say, a franchise and didn't do it in the other. And we got warned off that by Jeff Pfeffer, as I recall, who basically said, we know all this already. This is not something we don't know. We don't need to do more research to find this out. What we have to figure out is the next step, which is now that we know all this, what are we going to do about it? And I think really this book, so just for those of you that might have just be joining us, the book is The Case for Good Jobs. Here's my pre-read copy, which I'm very proud of. And the book is basically about, okay, we know this. We know good jobs lead to better life satisfaction, better outcomes, you know, better families. I mean, parents with good jobs do a better job as parents. We know people that have good jobs in their community are stronger, more stable communities. The other twist I would make on it too is if you think about organizations that have to continuously adapt, you know, there's constant change, there's constantly things going on in their lives. If you have to wait for management to figure out what that looks like, you're way behind, right? Whereas if you can push kind of decision-making and movement to the edges of your organization, you're going to be much more flexible, much more adaptive, much more likely to be able to meet customers where they are than the other way around. So
exactly. During the last economic crisis, Mercadona, one of the companies I studied for, one of the first examples of companies that thrive with good jobs, Spanish supermarket chain, competes on the basis of low cost. And during the first economic crisis, 2008-2009 economic crisis, from 2009 to 2010, they were able to reduce their prices by 10%. Now, this is a single digit profit margin industry. Being able to reduce prices that much is a huge deal. Why were they able to do that? Because their frontline employees came up with so many different ideas. Mm-hmm. But why are they able to have so many ideas? First, they're empowered. That's one of the choices of the good job strategy, standardize and empower. Second, they have time to be able to come up with ideas because these companies operate with Slack. Third, these companies focus and simplify. So they are very, you know, they don't sell so many different products. They don't do so many things. So their employees can focus on the job, be familiar with the products and services that they offer. So it's a system. It's an adaptive system that adapts to changes. And it is a very obvious, I remember I was telling you before, Rita, Greg Foran, the former CEO of Walmart, said, the good job strategy is blindingly obvious. Now, no academic likes to think that her work is blindingly obvious, but of course it's obvious. The four choices of the good job strategy, you know, the first is focus and simplify. What's operations management, what strategy professor would say strategy is? Be all things to all people, right? I mean, like, I don't know, maybe you're in that field, maybe you've heard of somebody, but it's just like, but focus requires courage because it requires not doing certain things. And it's been amazing to see how much courage it requires not, you know, to be able to focus and simplify, standardize and empower. I mean, that has been the work design principle from Toyota production system years ago. Cross-train, you know, Richard Heckman talked about, you know, task variety as being motivating. Cross-train in my field of operations creates flexibility. Operate with Slack. Like anyone who has taken queuing theory knows that that is the optimal approach to staffing. So these operational choices are not risky choices. And this is something that I try to explain in the book now, because one reason why leaders don't adapt a system that is blindingly obvious is because it's a system. And it requires, and in their current system of vicious cycle, where so many things are going wrong, they haven't hired the right people, they haven't trained them well, they can't empower their employees, they can't manage capacity like we talked about in the beginning. They think, how am I going to change the whole system? It just seems overwhelming to them. There are, when we do a workshop with companies, there are like 87 things that they have to change. They come up with these ideas on their own after a two-day workshop. So it seems overwhelming and too risky. But what de-risks these system change is one, what you what you are changing is blindingly obvious. Like there's no risk to doing these. The second is that you don't have to make all of these changes all at once. We have found out now, and it's described in the last part of the book, how do you, in a system change, there are certain points, that certain changes that you can make early on to escape the vicious cycle without breaking the bank. Mm-hmm. You can invest in your people and subtract workload at the same time. And when you combine those two changes, two big changes at the same time, you can get out of the vicious cycle as quickly as possible and get on, you know, create momentum to make future changes. And then the third thing that reduces the risk is how many people in the organization want to make this change, right? I mean, you work with so many companies, there is a change fatigue, right? Oh, this leader comes in, they bring their own thing. Yes, this shall pass.
The boss went to another conference.
Oh, exactly. Now, or the boss read another book. Oh my God. But when, you know, when we bring together the different functions in the home office and they're in the same room for 2 days, and when they see how much their decisions end up hurting the front lines and their ability to serve the customer and their productivity, once they become aware and once they see it, they can't unsee those things. Mm-hmm. So, and they want to change. Like nobody has bad intentions. Mm-hmm. Nobody wants to do this. And that's what gives me, you know, that's why I'm very optimistic that as we show more examples of system change being possible, we'll encourage more leaders to take this path, mm-hmm. and make a change for their companies. And it's good for, you know, the icing on the cake is it's good for our society, as you said.
Absolutely. Well, and I know I remember when you were debating founding the Good Jobs Institute, and it was a pretty pivotal moment, you know, just if you think about your own career. Because it was going to be a departure from what you would have done, right? Which is written a lot of scholarly articles on operational themes, and maybe somebody paid attention and maybe they didn't. But this was an opportunity to actually summon a critical mass of people and ideas about making this a resource for organizations that wanted to do a better job. And I think a better job at better jobs. And I think that's just so A, interesting, B, laudable, but C, such a resource. And so just a couple of things I want to make sure our listeners take out of this. And by the way, if we don't get to all of your comments, there are a lot of comments. What I'll do, Zeynep, is I'll copy them and send them to you, and maybe we do a little write-up afterwards and respond to them if we didn't get too live. But so on the website, the Good Jobs Institute website, there's a free survey that you can actually take. If in the privacy of your own computer, you just want to see where you stand, you can actually get a free assessment, right?
Yes, and I think the best thing would be, you know, reach out to Sarah Kellogg, our executive director, and have a conversation if you're interested. We haven't updated that survey in a while, so I'm not sure. I think we did that maybe 5-6 years ago. But one of the things, yeah, but it is, we have worked with a wide range. I get to work with my former students, which is fantastic for me. People who were in my classroom are now my colleagues, and we get to work with companies to make the system change. Mm-hmm. But yeah, goodjobsinstitute.org, we have lots of free resources. You can read about change stories on our website. You can, there are tools that we have that in addition to the surveys. We walk through step by step how to make a living wage assessment in your own organization. Mm-hmm. So there are lots of different tools that one could use. And I was, when the first book came out and leaders started reaching out saying, we're in that vicious cycle, we would like to change, but we don't know how to change. We don't know what to do first. Can you help us? And my first reaction, Rita, was, you said I was nervous. No, like I have a job, I have 4 kids, and I don't know how to help you. And I remember one night, Roger Martin, we were having dinner together. And that day I had received a phone call from this legendary retail CEO. And I was telling Roger about our conversation. And Roger said, why was he calling you? I said, well, he was calling to ask me if I would work with them to adopt a good job strategy. And he said, what did you say? And I said, well, I told him I'm not a consultant. I don't do this stuff. Like, and he said, that's the worst answer you could have given him. And I'm like, Roger, I don't really know how to help. And then he committed to help me to help companies. And at the time, one of my star students, Sarah Kellogg, she joined me to do this. So it's been an interesting experience moving away from that academic side into being more of a practitioner and learning alongside with companies.
Well, but you bring that wisdom. I mean, people always ask me, oh, you know, what's it like to be an academic? And, you know, with a certain sort of, oh, you people are so theoretical. But in my opinion, the academic training provides things that a lot of practitioners don't have, which is a keen appreciation of boundary conditions. What really is the difference between causation and causality? How big are effects? Like, it has an effect, but is it a meaningful effect? And, you know, that kind of training, there's no substitute for that in my sense, when you're really trying to solve real world problems. So I would say, and I'm as much on the practice side as you are, I believe in having an impact on companies, but at the same time, I don't think that the academic background is necessarily a negative. I think it actually, in many cases, is sort of almost a superpower. So toward the back of the book, you've got kind of remedies, calls to action, things people can do. So somebody who's hearing this as well, that sounds sort of interesting. Maybe it's new. Where do they start? So visit the website, read the book, obviously get the book, read the book, and maybe get inspired. And then what?
Yeah. And if you really want to adopt this in your organization, where to start is, don't make this about jobs. Don't make this about frontline jobs. Make this about winning. Make this about a business need. Companies that were able to adopt a good job strategy adopted it because they created urgency around a business need. They said, okay, you know, Mudbay, a retail chain in the Northwest, they have about 30, 35 stores and they sell pet products. And e-commerce is taking away sales from them. So they asked themselves, are we going to be able to survive if we don't offer a compelling reason for our customers to come to our stores? At Moe's Original Barbecue, during COVID, they were affected tremendously. Their sales went down, their customers were not coming back, their employees didn't want to work, their turnover was high, and they thought, how are we going to survive? How are we going to grow? The only way we can do that is if we provide good, consistent food, delicious food to our customers and serve them well. And we can't do that if we don't change the way that we operate. So my number one advice, I think, is make this about winning. Make this about a business need, not I want to be nice to my employees. Of course, everybody wants to be nice to their employees. But once you have that customer-centric thinking, then decision-making becomes a lot easier. So that's number one. And the number two is to get the different functions in the home office aligned on this change. Because the work that frontlines do, as we've talked during the last 40 minutes, is driven by decisions that are made by people who don't think about how their decisions affect the work. In a restaurant business, the digital, the group in the digital takeout, how do we create those products? They affect the workload and the work in the stores. Menu design, that affects the workload. Supply chain, logistics, you know, the suppliers, deliveries, all that affects the workload. So get all the functions whose decisions affect the work in the stores or in the units to be aligned on this. And this goes not just for retail stores or restaurants, but for factories, for fulfillment centers, for even nursing homes. We've seen, you know, how much disconnect there was between, you know, what HR and restaurants and all those different functions would put to the front line. So that would be my number two. And then once you align everyone, then just read chapter 9 in terms of what changes to make first and why to make those changes to be able to get on to create a momentum.
I love that. I love that. So one of the things that I think is very keen about your theory and that does directly come from operations is this whole concept of Slack. Mm-hmm. And the reason I raise it is that in many circles that have been sort of infected with, I'll call them extreme Taylorist views of the world, Slack is an enemy. You know, Slack is something to be designed out of your system. And when I say Slack, for those of you that aren't familiar with the term, what that means is resources that are available to be put to unexpected uses. So it's, you're not running with extreme efficiency that any little disruption throws you off course. You've got enough kind of vacant time or space to cope with unexpected, with the unexpected. And so it seems to me we've almost got these two systems running in parallel. So on the one hand, you've got this very Taylorist, absolutely optimize your supply chain robots working in these intricate dances, you know, the kind of stuff Christopher Mims writes about in his book, Arriving Today, Global Supply Chains Optimized Within an Inch of Our Lives. And I think one of the things we learned in the pandemic and in the subsequent supply chain disruptions that followed and the sort of breakdown of global connections that we're still experiencing is that lack of slack at a certain point is actually quite dangerous, that, you know, you need degrees of freedom. You need wiggle room for the unexpected. And as more things become unexpected, we need to have a little more slack. And we've known about innovation for years. Innovation cannot thrive if you're optimized. It just doesn't. You need slack. You need time for people to think about stuff. You need time for tinkering that isn't necessarily immediately job related. And we know all this. And again, this is back to, like, from where I'm coming from. When I say this, this is blindingly obvious. And yet, when you look at how day-to-day decisions get made, the slack gets squeezed out of the system and people feel that they don't have the agency to make decisions that everybody knows would be in the customer's best interest, right? So how do you respond when people push back on this idea of maybe optimizing is not the best path to a good outcome?
And if you are truly optimizing, you would operate with slack. I mean, we teach our students capacity management and queuing theory. In the queuing theory, what you learn is that operating with nearly 100% capacity utilization is a really, really bad idea because the queue length increases exponentially. I mean, it's just like, that's what we teach our students. But when companies, you know, Toyota production system, our Good Jobs Institute works a lot with Toyota because, you know, I come from the operations world. So of course I'm a student of Toyota production system. The fact that our colleagues have called it lean production system has not been a great thing because Toyota is not lean. You know, Toyota does operate with slack, and the more variability there is, the more slack they put in. So it's a misunderstanding that lean and mean is more efficient. So what do we do? Well, one of the things we have found out, Rita, working with companies, is if you have a system that has so much variability, so employee turnover is high, there are attendance problems, people have not been trained, you haven't hired the right people, there's a lot of variability on your supply side, there's a lot of variability on the work and workload side, we encourage companies to add slack by taking out workloads and by improving the skill levels and the attendance and turnover of their employees. So that's how we create slack in the beginning, because adding more hours in an unstable system is really expensive. So the first thing on a good jobs journey is not to add more hours, but to say, what are all the non-value added activities we're asking our frontlines to do? Where can we subtract workloads? What are we offering to our customers? Because our financial way of operations meant that we added anything that increases sales without thinking about what our customer value proposition is and sticking true to our customer value proposition. So we first work with companies to take out as much as possible, and that's how you create that slack in the system. And without the slack, I mean, people make more mistakes, right? There are customer service problems, lost sales, burnout. We work with companies where managers, frontline managers, asked to be demoted because of burnout. And because it was just, they had anxiety disorders. It was just too much for them. So without slack, so many things do fall apart.
Mm-hmm. I love that perspective. I love that perspective. And I like the idea that it also comes from, it's almost like an engineering thing, right?
Yes.
And yet when we put these concepts into the hands of managers, so often they make just the wrong decisions.
Because if your mindset is people are a cost to be minimized, you just try to minimize. I mean, that's how we train. Again, that's where just yesterday, the day before yesterday in that workshop, I put the normal curve and I say, this is the workload. And let's say on average, the workload is 100 units of labor. How many units of labor would you staff your unit with? And many people said, we will staff with 100. And like, but then 50% of the time, you're going to be understaffed.
Right.
So, but if we think that the cost of, you know, the immediate cost is so much more important than all the understaffing costs, then of course, you know, we move towards understaffing and not having slack in the system.
That's interesting. So do you think some of these new technologies, I'm thinking of, you know, collaboration technologies, things that allow remote workers to connect. Do you think those are contributive to potentially building more good jobs?
I'm not sure, because for the settings that I have been studying have been, you know, frontline settings, you know, in hospitals, in nursing homes, in factories, in fulfillment centers, in retail stores, restaurants. You can't do the work remotely. Right. So for those types of jobs, there's little effect. But for other types of jobs, I mean, it seems like a lot of people want to have hybrid work. And that also shows us, you know, cost of living is very expensive in so many places. So people can't afford to live where they work, which means they live far away, which means that they don't want to take that long transportation to come to work. I mean, this is also giving us some insights into like the day-to-day lives of not just the frontline workers, but for other workers as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's a huge debate, right? You know, we'll see where companies are landing on it. But I think the other schism that I've noticed, certainly post-pandemic, is you've got these frontline workers, and then you've got these workers who aren't, you know, who maybe work remotely or work whatever. And I think one of the risks of the kind of hybrid remote dual class citizenship that some companies are now experiencing is it's easy to get even more disconnected from what's going on with the front lines of your organization, which I think can be kind of problematic. So if more companies, let me just think about it. If more companies adopt this, right, and it does show up in better performance, improved top line, better result, and will that be a competitive disadvantage for the companies that don't?
Look, right now, there are so many companies that don't adopt this, and some of them perform better than others. Like, we think that management and execution is constant across companies, but it's not. No. And there are so many different, you know, if you think about the strategy sphere, there are so much room for excellence in different ways. So mm-hmm. I think what we would have is excellence in so many different settings. And I don't see why it would come have any, you know, put anybody at a disadvantage. Labor costs, you know, the input costs might rise. So you need to find more ways to increase productivity of workers, because mm-hmm. if many more companies offer good jobs, of course, then labor costs are the wages will have to increase with it. But I see this as a path toward excellence for our society in general. And mm-hmm. it will take away from, there's a lot of space. It will be so nice if we had a supermarket chain that focused on fresh food, but in an excellent way, another one that focused on low cost, but in an excellent way, another one that focused on convenience, but in an excellent way. There are so many ways to compete.
Absolutely. I love that. But what I guess I was thinking was, you know, if I'm going head to head with a competitor and the competitor has a good job strategy and I don't, first of all, chances are my good people are going to go work for them. And if I'm dealing with turnover and all these other issues, I'm just not going to be as effective and adaptive competitor as.
And this is where I would be willing to make a bet that company, I mean, think about this. Let's say two different companies, right? One of them has low pay, high turnover, low productivity, but they're making a lot of money. Another one, high pay, low turnover, high productivity, they're making the same amount of money. Which of these companies is a stronger company, right? In the one that has the low pay, high productivity, low pay, low productivity, and high turnover, you can't empower workers, you can't hire the right people, you can't manage capacity. Yes, you can grow by adding more product services, but it's a really weak system. The other one is winning with high pay, low turnover, high productivity, and creating much better service to customers. And they have the execution muscle. They have the operational execution muscle. So which one would you bet? Like, which one would you be an investor on? I would rather be an investor on the good jobs company, because in the future, when things change, they can adapt to those changes. And we've also seen how technology adaption is also faster at companies with good jobs. At Sam's Club, what they have found was stores that had more tenured associates were able to adapt technologies faster because those associates could see how the new technologies improved their work, improved their ability to serve the customer, and they became ambassadors. Mm-hmm. So technologies don't come and say, oh, you know, a robot comes, I'm going to take your job. No, you know, you have to first create the right technology for the front lines. That requires input from the front lines. You have to be able to scale it, adapt it, and all that requires capable, motivated employees. So I would bet that in terms of a competitive strategy, those who do this will be better. I mean, I wrote my first book in 2014, and the companies I studied for my first book, Costco, Mercadona, Quick Trip, these companies I studied in 2009, 2010, they're still, you know, 13 years later, these companies are still winning with their customers. They're still creating great value for their investors because they have changed. Mm-hmm. They have adapted to changes and their customers want to come back. Their employees still want to work for them and their investors are delighted.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think that's very powerful, very powerful. So we have a few minutes and I don't want to infringe too much on your time. So the book is The Case for Good Jobs. It's the follow-on to The Good Job Strategy by Zeynep Tom, a professor at MIT and co-founder and I guess CEO, I'm not sure what your title is, but the force of nature behind the Good Jobs Institute. So people who tuned in, people who are watching afterwards from the recording, how do we get smarter? What do we do? Obviously visit the website. Are there other things that we would encourage you would encourage people to do to learn more?
Yes, read the book, visit the website, reach out to us. And I hope if you end up making changes, please let us know. Yesterday, I was doing a LinkedIn session with MIT's executive education, and one person wrote, we adopted good job strategy in our service operations and had great performance. I'm like, who are you? Well, please let me know if you use this, because maybe you could be a case study for others. So please do tell us if you end up making changes.
I know. I love that. I had a person in class a week or two ago who was with a very large government agency, and he's in charge of the call centers. And he said, you know, I have to tell you, I came into this class asking the question, how do I make the 90 million calls a year that we get handled more efficiently? He said, and I'm walking out of this class asking, why do I get 90 million calls for help every year? Why did I fix that?
Rita, I mean, Quest Diagnostics, when they adopted the good job strategy, one of the first things that they did was take out those calls. And another company we work with, financial services company, there were so many calls that should not come to the company at all. But they ended up not taking that out because they never put this as part of winning with customers and they never prioritized this. Yeah. But that was, and maybe I'll end with, you know, both of us know the late Clay Christensen. And I have so much admiration for Clay Christensen. And he used to tell his students, he used to say, management is the most noble profession if it's practiced right. Mm-hmm. Decisions that managers make has a huge impact on the lives of people who are working with them. That's a privilege. Mm-hmm. And I hope, you know, people use that privilege more carefully.
I love that. What a great sentiment to close on. So Zeynep Tom, thank you so much for your time. I'm really looking forward to maybe getting that joint project underway at some stage. We've got this book behind you. And for all of you listening, have a wonderful weekend. Thank you for dropping in. We will follow up on the chat and best of luck with putting the good job strategy to work wherever you are.
Thank you so much, Rita. Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks, everyone. Bye.